You're listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode 109 for December 22nd, 2010.
Everybody, this is the Experience Points Podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
My name is George Albor.
We are the co-creators of experiencepoints.blogspot.com, a website created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And it's the end of the year.
It is. We have our hot chocolate and bourbon.
Yep, I'm in my slippers.
And my silk bathrobe.
And we have come down from the mountain to tell you, the humble listener, the best game of the year. Nah, actually, we're just going to say our favorite games of the year because we don't want to be labeled as pretentious D-bags.
Yeah, you know, every year people around this time come out and name their games of the year. And, you know, it's pretty controversial, I think. There's actually a lot of people who really hate this process.
Yeah.
And I actually think that there's something really valuable for going back and reflecting upon the year. Because we really don't get a chance to do that very often. I mean, you and I do on the occasion when we talk about an older video game we've just gotten around to playing.
Yeah.
But by and large, you know, we don't tend to think about a slew of games that we've played recently. It's always, you know, what's coming next and what sort of games are we playing right now. So I think it's exciting to talk about some of our favorite experiences of the year. And again, these are just our favorite experiences. We haven't played all games.
Speak for yourself, you know. George. I'm 24/7 jacked into the game matrix.
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm just saying because if there's like an iCarly fan out there, I didn't play the iCarly game. Sorry.
Oh man. Okay. So starting from there, why don't you lead us off here? What's one of your favorite games?
Okay. Well, I'm gonna start off with something that was not difficult for me to pick at all, because I actually had a really hard time trying to think about what were my favorite experiences of 2010. And there were some that I completely forgot about. I don't know if this happened to you, but 2010 has been a pretty long year.
Yeah.
But I'm going to start out with a game that came out in February, I believe, and that's Mass Effect 2.
Ah, yes.
Everyone knows I love Mass Effect 2. It's not a strange thing that this appears on my list in the slightest. What I do want to do, however, is talk a little bit about the DLC that BioWare came out with. And Bioshock 2 is a fantastic game, and I've talked about it many times before. So just to talk about the DLC, there's three narrative expansions that they came out with. One was Kasumi's Stolen Memory. Another was called Overlord. And the latest one was called Lair of the Shadow Broker. And I got to play all of them. And it's really interesting because, except for maybe Overlord, the other two kind of play and experiment with the capabilities of storytelling in the Mass Effect universe. And I think it's a really kind of a neat way to experiment with the existing game, the existing mechanics. And I think it's indicative of why Mass Effect 2, in my opinion, is such an improvement on Mass Effect 1. Is because even when Mass Effect 2 didn't succeed, it didn't succeed in the process of trying to make things better. Do you know what I mean? I don't think BioWare pulled any punches. I think they were genuinely trying to make a better experience and were willing to take these risks.
So it was an experimentation thing using the DLC.
Yeah, so like Kasumi's Stolen Memory is essentially a heist game. And it doesn't actually lend itself very well to the heist experience. I don't think that it recreates the feelings of, you know, the best, I don't know, what's a, you know.
It's not like the Italian Job or you know,
yeah, or
like
Ocean's 11 through whatever, and you know, even Monaco, which will probably come out next year, looks like it's going to be achieving that heist sensation a little bit better. But regardless, you know, this is a third person shooter here, and I played this DLC that is ostensibly a heist sequence for a very long, elongated sequence that was really entertaining and fun, and you know, and Commander Shepard, you know, puts on a dress instead of her gun pack and kind of navigates this upper crust society meeting and, you know, this, you know, nicely decorated kind of palace thing. And then Overlord told a really good sci-fi story. I don't think that it experimented as much as the other two. And Lair of the Shadow Broker was really neat. And it offered, not only did it bring back some very important story elements that weren't incredibly widely discussed in Mass Effect 2, but it gave you this little kind of, I guess you could call it a sort of information base, mm-hmm. and let you kind of peek into different people's lives. And the strange thing is, it feels very much like a nod to the player. And Lair of the Shadow Broker has these dossiers on everyone who's in your crew, and they kind of like make stuff up, and it's really bizarre and actually a little bit upsetting, because some of them include like dating profiles.
Oh man.
You know, like Miranda, for example, has has done one of those, what are those, like internet dating sites.
She's on OkCupid right now.
Like. Yeah, she's on OkCupid essentially, and she's, you know, meeting all these like Krogan and stuff and having dates, and it's bizarre. But anyway, yeah, Mass Effect 2 I think is fantastic, and I think their DLC was really cool.
That's actually one of the games that, you know, I have kind of a side list of games that I wish I played or wish I got around to. And it's because of the exact thing that you just described. Like, it seems they are really experimenting with the franchise as it goes along. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but even as far as the way the shooting and item system and all that, it was experienced a pretty major overhaul from part one to part two.
Absolutely. And a lot of people criticized it because it was overly streamlined.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they went a little bit too far. In response to the claims that people had with the first Mass Effect's item system and item management.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it worked really well. My only concern is that, you know, the game is built so much into this trilogy, and we're told this game is going to, your decisions in Mass Effect 2 are going to affect Mass Effect 3 in an even greater way mm-hmm. than those from Mass Effect 1 affected Mass Effect 2.
Wow.
And considering how experimental they are, I'm interested to see what they do in Mass Effect 3, which they just announced, because, you know, if they change things too much, it might not feel like you're getting that same experience.
And it gets more and more complex as you go on too. It's harder to keep all those threads in order, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I do think, and I mentioned it, in some past posts of mine, but I think that the success of Mass Effect 2, how we remember it, is going to depend largely upon the success of Mass Effect 3.
Mm. Well, I'm excited to see Part 3 come out then, because, you know, even if I don't end up playing it, I've enjoyed being a spectator to everyone's posts about it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. The universe is super rich, and, I have a lot of faith in the doctors.
Mm. Yes. Well, let me jump in with one of my favorite games of 2010. Something that is not as experimental as Mass Effect, not as cerebral as Mass Effect. The only relation to doctors it has is that he sees a lot of the insides of people. And this is God of War 3.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, man, I forgot this came out in 2010.
Yeah, a pretty early one. I think it was either February or March. But, I mean, I'm a longtime fan of the series. And rather than radically overhaul the systems or you know, add a morality system or something like that to it, it really perfected the combat of God of War, and it took Kratos's character arc. I know you're laughing out there, everybody, but he does have some pretty interesting characterization. It took it to its conclusion. Both things were really satisfying, and It was really great to see them finish it off strong like that, even though I'm sure they'll make dozens of more games. But it was the end of the main PS2, 3 God of War trilogy, and it was very satisfying.
Do you feel that... Are you nervous about them continuing the franchise in any way, or...?
Well, I mean, they already put out that other game...
That was on the PSP, right? Chains of Olympus?
And they put out another PSP game. I think that was the... I think it was Ghost of Sparta.
That's right.
And it takes place in another point in time. I think it predates God of War 3, but I'm not sure. But you know, in true franchise fashion, the ending of God of War 3 left it open for the possibility of more Kratos. So, you know, I understand the business angle of it, and I understand, and you know, I wouldn't mind seeing more. Because I honestly think that it's a really interesting game, and they do a lot of things with the gameplay to back up Kratos's emotions and his ideology.
Yeah, I mean, the final killing of Zeus.
Yeah.
Is amazing.
I mean, Kratos is a simple character. You know, he loves destroying things, and he hates everything, and it's all borne out through playing the game. Nothing in that game is subtle. All the button presses are hard presses. There's never any feathery movement, even when you're doing something as mundane as opening up a treasure chest. He smashes it open, you know, like, yeah. Everything in the game is dedicated to his anger, and it's rare to see a game go so full tilt towards one specific theme.
You know, I've been looking at some of the Game of the Year choices from other websites and whatnot, and I actually haven't seen God of War 3 appear as much as I thought it would. Do you think that, like, the series gets as much praise as it deserves?
I think that it made its big splash on the PS2, and the, especially God of War 3 to God of War 2 feels much more incremental. I mean, they made some big changes to the battle system with the attack that lets you draw yourself towards an enemy, which was completely new and changed the way I play it a lot. But as far as how it looks and how the, you know, and how the enemies attack you and how you have to handle your situations, I mean, they're very similar games, so I feel like there might be diminishing returns in terms of the wow factor.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
But, you know, still, it's a gorgeous game, and, you know, the difficulty scales pretty well, and so I'd recommend it for people that aren't too squeamish and enjoy a good brawl.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I think it probably would have made my list if I had remembered that it came out this year. So.
Just don't tell Kratos that. Okay, what's your next one?
So my next list is a downloadable game that I was genuinely surprised that I would enjoy. And it's not Limbo, although I really enjoyed Limbo. It's Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this came out maybe, I think it was only a couple months ago. And it's a top-down, it's nothing like Lara Croft. It's a top-down dual-stick shooter. Slash platformer. There's strange platforming elements and puzzle elements, and this is actually one of the reasons why I had such a great time with this game. And I don't think it's perfect by any means, but you know, when I'm formulating my list of best games of the year, it always comes down to, well, you know, what are the moments that I remember being so much fun and so engaging at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing Lara Croft with a friend of mine because it's cooperative.
Yep.
And each of both Lara and the Guardian, this, I forget his name, he's like some Aztec.
Oh, yeah, fellow. Yeah.
Each of you have different, different unique things you can do in the battlefield. And they do an amazing job of level design in this game where you need the other player to succeed. And you could theoretically, go through the levels on your own. And certain aspects of the levels, but most of the time you need that other person, but it doesn't feel like you're using them. And it also makes for really neat moments where they'll like turn on you or make you die, or something will happen that you didn't expect to happen because they've got your back.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way where Lara can send her grappling hook, for example, and catch the guy who jumps,
mm-hmm.
or vice versa. And so it makes for really cool moments when, you know, your partner has to take a leap of faith and then you have to save them in the last minute. Or maybe you don't save them. Maybe they die and it's hilarious.
There's right? a lot of like boomerang or like bolo type action where you're connected to the other person and just kind of like flinging yourself around the level that I found really amusing.
Yeah. And in all actuality, the game actually looks really nice. It's a very pretty, gorgeous looking game. The dual stick shooter works absolutely perfectly fine. And so does the platforming and so does the puzzle elements. It all felt really nice and fresh. And it's so interesting seeing the Lara Croft reboot that we're getting now,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about, how people feel about Lara Croft in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had no trouble buying this game. I don't know. Maybe I'm just not as biased against her as some other people are. But I feel like the Guardian of Light proved that you can have a fun and purely fun. You know, there's not some grand narrative in the game. It's a fairly straightforward, you know, I'm entering a temple to stop a bad guy from destroying the world kind of gig.
Yeah.
And it works. And I think that's really where Lara Croft, I think, should reside. I don't think that we need to have her as this, this gritty kind of Drake from Uncharted-esque, woman. I'm perfectly fine with the Indiana Jones version.
It'll be interesting to see how that console slash PC reboot of Lara Croft turns out, because you know, it definitely doesn't look anything like the Guardian of Light. I mean, they're really eschewing the cartoonish quality of that game.
I wonder if they'll even get rid of her British accent.
Hmm. I don't know. That's pretty interesting, though. I always forget that she has a British accent.
And the way that people perceive, I think, British accents, correct me if I'm wrong, you're in England. How do you view British accents? I mean, and generally in the United States, people view British accents as, you know, academic and intellectual and clean and, you know. I mean, unless you have some really crazy Cockney accent.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll give her like an EastEnders treatment or something.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe she'll have some like, you know, really thick Irish accent or something.
Well, speaking of ethnic stereotypes, maybe I should jump in with my next with my next favorite game of the year. And that is Super Mario Galaxy 2.
I am not surprised in the slightest.
No, of course you're not, because I love Mario games. And kind of like God of War 3... Super Mario Galaxy 2 is an extension of what was happening in Super Mario Galaxy 1. I think I might actually like it better than the first one, in that they were able to play with the level design a little bit more freely. Overall, it's more difficult in my estimation. I found myself retrying things much more often than I did in the first game. And because they put in some new tricks and tweaks in the levels. So you'll have levels fold over themselves, kind of like an Inception style scene.
And someone needs to match up the Mario Inception to the Inception film trailer.
I mean, it feels like that, because you're never quite sure what's going to happen when you jet into one of those galaxies. That they played a lot more with transparency is physical and what is real. There was just a lot more of a fantasy vibe to it. And again, at the same time, they went traditional in some levels. There was a lot of two-dimensional stuff that all of a sudden the camera would swing and it would become three-dimensional, or it would be top-down. So the environments were just so meticulously designed to work in so many different perspectives. You know, it's just something that I don't see happening. I think Super Mario Galaxy in general stands up to some of the most experimental indie games out there, which is pretty shocking, because it's from the most corporate place you could possibly come from, you know, the Japanese offices of Nintendo.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even actually play the game. And one of the reasons is because I haven't played the first Galaxy, and, you know, it's actually a very time-consuming game.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm kind of a coward, and there's some very difficult aspects to Mario Galaxy. And I know that if I commit myself to playing Galaxy 2, I'm gonna lose, and I'm gonna give up at some point, and I'll just be embarrassed and won't be able to celebrate. But just watching it alone, there were moments that would just blow my mind. I couldn't believe that they were doing that. You know, yeah. Some of the levels, especially, I thought that were especially exciting, were the ones that were really small and spherical, mm-hmm. that you could go through and then activate something that would make the world become flooded with water.
Yeah.
You know, and it feels like one environment changes the physical landscape and therefore the mechanics just instantaneously, you know, without even realizing it. One map will suddenly become very different, you know, almost in a way. It almost reminds me of Left 4 Dead 2. In the map where it floods and you have to go back through it again, you know, the
fact that kind of layered design.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just that. Like even the way that they place new stars and green stars in different locations fundamentally changes how you approach and view a level. Mm-hmm. So one level can be approached to some extent in like six different ways.
Yep, and it's all if you want to do it. Like, you could probably make it through that game with a minimum of effort, you know, get 70 stars and just have a great time. But if you want to really dig into it, I mean, it just keeps going and going. It's a black hole of Mario goodness.
Yeah, and you know, that's why maybe I didn't do it. I don't know. I need to go back. I'm ashamed, I'll admit.
Nah, don't be ashamed. Mario's always welcoming.
Okay, well, out of curiosity, where do you think it can go next? Fourth dimensions?
Mario will time travel? Mario through time. They already had Mario is missing, so maybe they do a kidnapping thing. I have no idea. I mean, we'll have to see how the 3DS turns out, because that might be something. I mean, it'll be another dimension.
If anyone can do it, it's Nintendo.
To be a fly on the wall when Miyamoto's pitching things, man. I mean, it'd be pretty fascinating.
You know, I bet you that he pitches things and people just go, "That's impossible. We just
can't do it." And then he's like, "No, actually, I'm the boss. You're gonna have to do this."
Yeah,
thing.
Exactly. Think of the way. You know, he strikes me as someone who like brings the brightest minds. You know, because I imagine Nintendo headquarters with Miyamoto were like, you know, the Manhattan Project.
Now we have become Shiva, destroyer of worlds.
Exactly. Well, to take us a jaunt into the past, my next game. I chose to wait.
Is this
last.
Your final game
it
that,
is my
we're,
final,
that we're going to talk about?
Final one, and I think it's your final one.
Okay, should we do 1, 2, 3 and say
I
it at the same
do
time
one,
to
two,
see
three,
if we
and say it? Because
yes. All right, ready? Let's see how it goes.
One, two, three.
Red Dead Redemption.
Red Dead Redemption.
Okay.
Yep. Was that what you said? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That didn't work out, but whatever.
Yeah, I genuinely thought about not selecting this because I knew you would.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, maybe I could put something else here that I could put Professor Layton and the Unwound Future in here. This would be great. But every time I thought about, you know, every time I compared one of my favorite games to Red Dead Redemption, and even though Red Dead Redemption had large segments of that game where I wasn't having a fantastic time, you know, I felt like I was, you know, pushing myself through a lot of the segments of Mexico, for example. And there's a lot of narrative flaws in the game. Every time I thought of that, I couldn't shake, like, but there's, it made me want to go back, you know? I feel like there's so much content there, and so
the
much,
the world was so,
you know,
rich.
Yeah, it's so rich, and there's so much historical, you know, there's so much historical things that the game talks about and doesn't talk about at the same time that just makes me, it kind of makes me realize, like, Red Dead Redemption is... I don't know. I hope it's one of many games that try to do something similar. I really hope Rockstar is not the only ones with the courage to undertake something that's so massive.
Yeah. And that touches something, especially in American culture, but worldwide to a certain extent as well. I mean, it's pretty brave to get into the cowboy Western genre because there's so much baggage associated with it in all different forms of media. And so it's just a massive, like, thematic undertaking. Like, what kind of Western are you going to be? Are you going to be, you know, shootout at the OK Corral type Western? Are you going to be, you know, a gritty Western like Unforgiven? Are you going to be like a sing-song Western, like, you know, Oklahoma or something? You know, it's just, there's so many paths you can go down, and it feels like the game tries to go down a few of them, and since
it's
so long, it does.
I also think it can experiment and go down a lot of these genre paths, and draws so much from different aspects of Western films and literature. And to sometimes I think that's to the detriment of the game. I genuinely think that there are times when it doesn't feel like a cohesive whole. But I think the reason is because I think Rockstar was probably willing to let a few individuals, you know, bring in different ideas and were genuinely trying to do as much as they could do, you know? And I think that it really pays off, especially if you're a fan of the genre like I am, and I think you are.
And, you know, to be even more specific about why I think the game resonated with me so much is that I think the Western, as Rockstar imagined it, is uniquely suited to the kind of open world game that Rockstar does. They made this game about a bleak expanse of land, and where sometimes random things happen, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, sometimes they're just neutral. You know, you don't help every person that comes by the road, and you don't necessarily search for everything in the world, but it's all out there. And at the end of the game, which was the bravest thing overall, is that the end of the game is bleak. Like, there's no clear redemption, despite what the title might tell you. Like, John Marston, you know, it's not a riding off triumphantly into the sunset type ending. And it feels like the Rockstar open world game is all about that. You put in these hours and hours and hours into their games, and what do you have to show for it at the end? All you really have to show for it is what you got out of it. There's no real external reward. And so it was a very unique instance of a game that is not necessarily fun, but that is the point of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the themes that, you know, that they have in the game, I think they're very aware, and I think that they really want players to think about this stuff and chew it over, you know? The Stranger quest line, for example, mm-hmm. I think is the most in your face about, you know, what redemption means and whether or not Marston is a, you know, whether or not he's even a good character, whether or not he's a good father. And, yeah. And I think that that quest line isn't heavy-handed. It's very clear that, you know, this is a topic that they want you to see. And, you know, even though you don't, I bet you a lot of people didn't even play the Stranger quest line all the way through.
You could easily miss him. He's just there on the map standing around.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that's indicative of what Rockstar was trying to accomplish with the game, which is, you know, making you... Rockstar is trying to make you think of these subjects, even though they force you to play within that universe in a strictly shooting way, right? There's, yeah. there's not puzzle elements. There's not dialogue choices like there is in Mass Effect 2. Mm-hmm. But I think they still raise really important and interesting issues from the Western genre, and even from today. You know, I think that there's, you know, what Westerns do so well is make us think about how we got to where we are today. And I think that they completely succeed in continuing that process. And I'm not alone in thinking that, you know, Red Dead Redemption is kind of setting up the path towards the Grand Theft Auto series in some way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at it as a, you know, the gameplay mechanics as an argument. Like, what is this saying about the themes of the Western or the themes of American development over the years? And it's not always a pretty thing. And so it starts to make you question, well, maybe there's a specific reason why I'm only shooting in this game. I totally agree. It's heady, but it's something that is, you don't really think about that when you think of Rockstar games as portrayed by the media. You know, they're murder simulators, you know, that sort of thing. But I mean, the way that they simulate all those murders that you have to do in Red Dead Redemption is very telling as to the type of story they're trying to tell. Just really, really impressive game. And just, I mean, how many hours did you spend in that place? I mean, it's really weird just to think about. Like, I kind of know landmarks in that game still. I haven't played it for a couple months, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I think about games like Animal Crossing, you know, where the world is persistent. And the way that I think about the world of Red Dead Redemption is as if it keeps going, you know? As if I could go back and visit it. And part of it is because the way that Red Dead ends, you know, makes it so that is kind of alluded to, that you can go back. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it makes me want to go back. It makes me want to see that world continue and, you know, and have more story arcs and more story elements and see, you know, how is Bonnie McPherson doing? That'd be great.
I mean, it's a beautiful purgatory. You know, it feels like the game had an ending, but it really doesn't have much of an ending. And that could be a good or bad thing, depending on how you liked the game. And so it's just, I can understand how someone, I could totally understand how someone wouldn't like it. And yet I think because of those reasons, it is an excellent game.
Yeah, absolutely. I still think I like Mass Effect 2 better, but, you know, Red Dead Redemption is incredibly important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we've talked people's ears off quite a bit. So maybe we should turn it over to everyone else. If you want to write in with your thoughts on the year, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
We also encourage you to leave your comments in the comment section to this podcast or any of our posts. We update the site Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday evenings, and that is experiencepoints.blogspot.com. So come on by and bring your friends and family.
All right, until next time, everyone, take care.
Bye-bye. Every time we disagree.